As it becomes clear that we're entering a time of environmental stress, does the value of indigenous knowledge start becoming more apparent? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Got examples of how mainstream Arctic or marine science benefits from talking to those who already live where they do their field work? Well, call us at 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. Statewide and toll-free, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. Science and the Indigenous is today's subject on Talk of Alaska, statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering that public transportation can benefit their businesses and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, and social opportunities. There's more information at alaskamobility.org. This message sponsored by the nonprofit organizations Alaska Mobility Coalition and the American Public Transportation Association. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
So we have a dynamite panel with you, and I want to start the show by basically meeting everybody that we'll be talking with. Our telephone number, once again, is 1-800-478-8255, and this is a fascinating subject and a moving target. And it's a moving target in part because everything is changing. The scientists are changing their paradigms. They're having to adapt to changing times. And the environment is changing, especially up in the Arctic. And so we have two people with us from the Arctic. First, joining us from Ilisavik College is Richard Glenn of the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, where he's Executive Vice President for Lands and Natural Resources. But he's also a geologist and a board member of a number of organizations, and on a whaling crew. Richard Glenn, it's a pleasure to have you on Talk of Alaska. How are you doing today?
Good morning. I'm feeling great, and thanks for having me here.
Richard, what is the value of being a geologist up in Barrow?
Yeah, so, geology is kind of a catch basin for a lot of studies, and so what I tried to do as a youngster was kind of marry up the studying of the Arctic environment from my experiences with my extended family and my friends around here with a program in the school where you could end up with something that's useful for everybody. And geology fit that for me, for my interest at the time. And it was a great opportunity to study everything from how the Brooks Range came together to what makes the, how sea ice and the freezing ocean changes throughout the season.
You know, it's no secret that the North Slope Burrow and the Arctic Slope, to a certain degree, are opposed and would just assume that there was not oil development offshore at all, that they concentrate on the onshore. And yet, somehow, I think you've been quite a part of this, there has always been a process of negotiation with the oil industry as they proceed with their activities, even though there's, you probably would just assume they weren't doing that and would leave the whales alone. And I wanted to ask you how you feel that process is going.
Yeah, that's a long process. There's a lot of history and water that's flowed under the bridge on that issue that starts from the very formation of our North Slope Burrow itself. And it continues through this day. There's learning going on both sides. There's sometimes reasons to come together, and there's sometimes, opportunities for folks to get their hackles up. And I think what we started 40 years ago has been a conversation that's been beneficial for both sides. The industry's practice improved with local input, and local folks here's lives were improved for the better with the beginning of development in our area, because we built things that improved the quality of life. And I think that's that's an entirely different conversation in and of itself. But it's decades and generations of conversation right there.
Well, I'm thinking about where things stand now in terms of the industry kind of agreeing to buffer zones for its seismic and doing no activities at all during the whale migration, and the value of all the new observation that's being done of sea ice at both sides. It just seems that the conversation has taken a more technical turn in the last few years, wouldn't you say?
Well, you know, you can go back even further and talk about how nearshore structures were created, how to avoid fish migration with causeways, or how to set up a pipeline that comes from a barrier island through the lagoon system in a way that respects the ice, and you know that. So yeah, there are early examples of that. But you're right, the technical conversation is changing. I mean, what we're just coming now off of a great set of meetings that were from current and sea ice researchers from the University of Alaska Fairbanks in Colorado. This is Matt Druckenmiller and Hayo Eichen and Tom Weingartner from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And we met with whaling captains from and basically ocean and ice experts from Nooksit, Barrow, Wainwright, and Point Lay. And we got the right people in the room, basically, to talk about ocean current observations, how it affects how things happen in the open water season, and how when the ice cover changes everything. For example, the radars can't map currents so good, but our people who are out on the ice continue to monitor currents over an ice cover, and because basically your safety depends on that. And so that's just a great example of. One, getting the right people together, sides that care about each other's knowledge, respect each other's experience, and that can benefit from it. I mean, if you get yourself in that spot where you have an expert talking to an expert, the cultural differences and the language barrier, all of that can disappear, and you have two people talking about something that they both respect. It's just it's something that's worth building your life around if you've ever seen it happen. And we've got countless examples of that go back generations. I mean, more than 100 years from our region alone.
Yeah, and I've been following Tom's work for quite a few years, and as he gets to the smaller scale of how these currents are operating up there, he's discovering that they're not real predictable. And I would think that probably local knowledge is extremely valuable, which is exactly the same thing you were just telling me, which I find that really, really fascinating. I'd like to turn to the other one up there at Ilisavik, who is Craig George. He's the wildlife biologist at the North Slope Borough Department of Wildlife Management. Been up there for a long time, mostly working on bowheads. Craig, welcome to Talk of Alaska. Hello, Craig.
Hello, Craig.
Yeah, okay, thanks. Yeah, can you hear us now?
Oh, yeah, I can hear you. We just have to kind of turn things up and down because of the delay, but I wanted to get you to talk a little bit about your whole family's involvement up there, because I know your mom has been a big part of the science scene up there as well, and she's known to many of our listeners as the author of that classic, Julia the Wolves.
Right. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I've been up here quite a number of years, and like Richard said, I've worked with the native community, primarily on bowhead whales, and it's been absolutely fascinating.
Well, it's a long story, and you know the whole story, but essentially the IWC had to be convinced that there were as many bowhead whales as there are, because they didn't want to believe it, right?
Well, I think that's basically right. The scientific evidence was pretty scant at the time. And most of the knowledge then was actually in the native community about population size and trend. Some of the senior captains had a pretty good idea that there were a fair number of bowheads and that they had definitely increased over their lifetime. But in the absence of a good estimate, things were it led to the moratorium of 1977, which is when I came to Barrow.
And so it was necessary to build a case.
Right. So slowly the information was pulled together, and I think some of the best example of this synergy between local knowledge and science was that some of the senior captains told us that we were missing animals that were swimming beneath 100% ice cover, which was a very difficult thing for the IWC scientists to believe at the time. They also told us that there were whales further offshore than could be seen from the shore-based operations. And what we did is we were perplexed by the problem, but we used acoustic surveillance to attempt to quantify, let's say, the number of animals that were being missed due to those two problems.
Yeah, now it's, the paradigm is kind of opening up again, as I understand it anyway, Craig, because they're listening and hearing all kinds of whales under the water now, under the ice, where they didn't really have grays. Not really knowing how the grays were finding places to breathe, but hearing them down there anyway, and so forth.
Yeah, there's some evidence that the gray whales were lingering late into the fall, and some evidence that some actually overwintered in this area. But it's a fairly uncommon event. But you're right, and as the bowhead whale population has increased, so has the call rates, and for some reason the amount of what we call these sequence calls or songs has increased to the point that it's frustrating the analysts right now while we're trying to come up with a new population estimate.
They're talking too much?
Yeah, well, basically, that's it. It used to be a fairly rare event to hear a bowhead song, and there was like the song of the year that most of the whales repeated, interestingly enough. But now it's almost constant singing, and we actually don't have a good explanation for it.
The elders are perplexed on this one too. Richard Glenn, you got any guesses, or you heard anything from the elders as to this phenomenon?
I got to tell you, Craig is my elder in this respect, as in many others. A guy is ahead of me in time, and that's just the thing about traditional knowledge is if you want to benefit from it, it's like a network, and you just got to get in line. And there's someone ahead of you that's learning themselves, and there's someone behind you that's also learning. And so it's a lifelong experience. But one thing Craig says that I think that we do observe is that there's more whales. And the whales are here longer. And what I've tried to tease out is, the whales are recovering from a load that happened during the commercial whaling era. And so how much of this is the whales just reestablishing an ancient distribution, and how much of it is growing into some place they've never been? And that's a tough difference to tease out. And I'm glad people like Craig are here that have worked this issue for decades.
I want to turn now to our third guest, who is joining us from Pocatello, where she is assistant professor of anthropology at Idaho State University, Kate Reedy-Mashner. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you, Steve.
It's great to have you on the show. You're on the SSC of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. How did you get picked for that?
Well, I've good friends with one of the council members, and they needed a replacement, a temporary replacement, actually, for one of the other social scientists who was going on sabbatical. I was supposed to be temporary, and when I arrived for my first meeting, I had been confirmed as permanent. So that was 2 years ago, and I'm still doing it. I love the work. It's very challenging, but it's very rewarding, too.
It's been my observation about that particular panel that if you're a hard worker, they really start using you.
That's true. They own you. Yeah. It takes over your life.
Right. Well, so this gives you a chance to come to Alaska, but actually you were also do field work here and as an anthropologist. So tell me a little bit about what that amounts to, because you're dealing with the Alaska Peninsula and the Aleutians and the Aleut people, which have such a tangled history in Alaska.
Right. So for the past 15 years or so, I've been working primarily on the peninsula, King Cove, Sandpoint, False Pass, Nelson Lagoon. And more recently, I've expanded further out the chain, Akutan and beyond. And I'm mostly an ethnographer, so I really describe their lives, and I talk to them about their history. I have a massive genealogy that includes almost every living Aleut that I know of, and it goes back multiple generations. I just keep track of that. And it's also a resource for the Aleut people. They sometimes call me and want to update it and want to talk about connections and histories there, too. But I just describe their lives, and the Aleutians are so spread out, and there's so many different communities. Well, not that many, but they're so different from each other and have such vastly different histories and different legacies. And, you know, Nikolsky has 18 people, on Alaska has almost 5,000. So there's vastly different scales as well. And so I try to capture all of that and capture how they manage to stay a unified group at the same time. But mostly I work with them on their fisheries. I really describe their relationship to commercial fishing. It is the number one business in the North Pacific and Bering Sea. And some of the communities have a stronger relationship with commercial fishing than others. And I try to document that. And fishing is a very volatile business. And the communities respond to that volatility, and I track that and worry about their future.
Well, yeah, as I'm sure they are.
Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, I have in hand your book, Aleut Identities, Tradition and Modernity in an Indigenous Fishery. And, you know, as you say, it's basically an ethnography with, you know, a lot of measurement of all this. But the key finding, if I'm right, maybe I'm right, is that you can really trace Aleut ways into the distant prehistoric past and find that they're really the same ways are still found today. And this is in spite of, like, you know, massive environmental change and the waves of colonization that were you know, severe, including the Americans who removed, you know, just depopulated the Aleutians during the Second World War.
That's correct. And actually, the depopulation of the Aleutians was uneven as well. So each community has a different history with that terrible event where people were evacuated and dumped in. Often abandoned canneries and places in Southeast Alaska, and basically left to fend for themselves. Not every village was evacuated, and the ones on the peninsula were not. So they have a different legacy there. But I do trace continuity with the past. These guys were prehistorically highly ranked, very aggressive people. They were engaged in warfare. They had chiefs and commoners, and they had slaves. They practiced polygamy and polyandry. I wouldn't say that's happening today. But they were engaged in trade and used a lot of the local products, marine mammals, fish, to trade and to increase their own status and wealth. And from that legacy, there are, you know, the multiple changes following the Russians coming in, reorganizing everybody, putting their own system of chiefs in place on top of that one, intermarrying, creating a Creole class, a Creole generation. But the basic structure remained the same, and the basic ways that they drew status and prestige from their environment and interacted with each other stayed the same. And then even after the American period, Scandinavian fishermen coming in, marrying locally, really turning the eastern portion of the Aleutians into commercial fishermen, really making that that become their culture. This whole system of status and prestige remains the same. And they're still an incredibly aggressive, well-organized group of people that they were thousands of years ago.
So let me ask you this as an anthropologist. And, you know, I think I probably know your answer, but I want to know kind of why. Is who owns this heritage? You know, there was a period in which art and artifacts and ceremonial objects were simply, you know, collected and sent to museums all over the world, Europe and so forth. And, you know, it seems now that, you know, there were even laws passed, NAGPRA, that required repatriation of objects. Often this is a quandary because, you know, the stuff needs taken care of and it's expensive to take care of. So we have but the thing is, there was an acknowledgement in the invading culture, I guess you would say, that realized that these ways weren't really disappearing, that was an oversimplification, that cultures were surviving and adapting and needed to be looked at as living things, and then that heritage needed to be repatriated. And I guess, you know, you're pretty strong on that.
Right. So the communities themselves really, I took my lead from them. They embrace these numerous heritages. It is part of who they are today. They don't explain away their history. They don't apologize for having Scandinavian ancestors. They've taken all of that, all those pieces of their past, and really made it their own. But it is different as you travel through the communities, the level of engagement with that history, all those vast histories, and how they present themselves. I'm not an archaeologist. My husband is an archaeologist. He's done tons of work in those communities, around those communities, and documented settlement history going back to 6,000 years and sometimes earlier. And the communities really welcomed that research because it gave them some time depth that they had not been able to demonstrate for a very long time, demonstrate in their negotiation with fishing, for fishing rights, and just to have a sense of their heritage and share it with one another. So they welcome all kinds of research, even though there's so few people working out there, partly because of travel challenges and the expense, and we have to be very very adept at waiting.
Yeah.
Sitting in airports and trying to get in and out. It's challenging to work there. But yes.
It's an amazing part of the world, you know, in terms of the wonderfulness of nature there and some of the what goes on and with natural forces and the very idea that there's a people that has managed to live in that and exist in that environment and keep adapting. It's probably got lessons for our future in it.
Absolutely. Very small places are still thriving. It's funny.
Yeah. And I, you know, your husband Herb used to tell me that you would sometimes be able to get stories out of living oral history that then could be found in the archaeological record, which must have been really exciting.
Yeah, so I can't think of a specific example offhand, but always when I would collect oral histories from people and talk about their, you know, use of the islands and use of the waters, and then I'd compare notes with my husband when he would be out surveying and excavating and finding all of these communities and places where the people said they were, and all the tools and technology to go with the lifestyle of those in those communities, those ancient villages. It's been really fun, really rewarding.
I want to turn back to the North Slope and Richard Glenn and Craig George and ask if you've got any questions to ask Kate. We can kind of run through that.
Oh, the issue of you touched on the issue of traditional knowledge. What is it? How do we deal with it? And what it isn't? And there are so many. So then there's this power of observation. I mean, that's the one thing that I think resonates with all of us is about, it's basically an awareness of our environment. And you, as you know, our environment changes so much in a given season that that you have to stay on top of it. And so we don't say, for example, on October 10th, the ice is always 5 inches thick every year. We say, you know, in fall time, we got to monitor the thickness of the ice in the lake, and when it's safe, we cross it. And so it's that ethic of basically staying in touch with the changes in your environment that is generations of trial and error, basically. And it's boiled itself down to a set of rules for survival. And so for I guess I'm less concerned about, you know, where the things are, but it's these rules or the methods for staying alive, navigating, avoiding frostbite, that they're, you know, or hunting or getting home or getting to a place. And so much of our traditional knowledge boils down to those things. That's the first thing that a researcher needs to know when he comes to our area from outside, which is, you know, how do I get out there and how do I get home safe? And once you move beyond that, then you're into what could be a series of elegant solutions to a complicated problems. And that, to me, is the second. I mean, it's a blessing. Traditional knowledge is a blessing when you start to be able to unravel those kind of issues.
I've been. Go ahead, Kate.
Well, I just thought that was a wonderful statement, that this generations of trial and error, and that's really what traditional knowledge is. It's generations of learned behavior of what works, what doesn't, and it is a gift.
It seems like sometimes at scale, you know, you've got scientists who want to deal with large patterns. Occurrence would be a good example. I mean, it must have been very clear, Craig, it must have been really clear that the currents were reversing back and forth along the coast there at Point Barrow, but they didn't really, the measurements weren't showing that until they got down to a really fine scale. And I'm sure people knew that. I can't imagine they didn't.
Well, sure, yeah, and it's certainly pretty obvious when you're camping on the ice. That's the main thing that one of the main things that we learned from the senior captains was when it was time to pull camp when we were doing our whale census observation. But I just want to make one comment on the similarity of, let's say, local knowledge, traditional knowledge, and science, is that they're both the collection of empirical data over time, and then it's tested through time, and it's updated. And in that sense, you know, the observations that are made here by the whaling community, you know, are clearly science. And we really benefited from that, and, you know, we are light years ahead doing our whale population abundance work by sitting on hundreds of years of local knowledge, so we knew when to get out there, where to count, the initiation of the migration, and then some of those details I mentioned earlier that, by the way, were confirmed that, you know, we can have thousands of whales literally migrating under 100% ice cover. And so, yeah, that it's been fascinating, but specifically you asked about currents. And, yeah, they shift north and south along the coast here during the spring. And we do track that. Specifically, it was to help us in our whale counting. We needed to know the current direction to make decisions about duplicate sightings and all. But then that led others like Hiawaiken and his crew to work more closely with scientists. They were interested in sub-ice currents, if I have it right, Richard, and then actually put out instruments in a place that most oceanographers would never do, and that's under in fairly shallow water under ice. But they've gotten some very interesting data, and there clearly are currents under landfast ice, which was not known to science, at least, prior to that.
Another one that comes to my mind is getting the time series, where often there are stuff buried in tradition that actually can be rendered out into being scientific data. I'm sure you've seen this happen, Kate.
Oh, absolutely. One of the projects I've been involved in is documenting stellar sea lion abundance and observations that the Aleut are making. We've used archaeological data to reconstruct population, the sea lion population for the past 4,500 years. And I've interviewed a lot of folks that they're out on their boats all the time. They're observing all the time. And they have oral histories from their ancestors telling them about sea lion behavior and abundance and then to be able to take those data and take the time series that they're observing, you know, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, and actually see it in the archaeological record has been very interesting.
It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about science and indigenous people as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. And by
ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
It's Talk of Alaska, the telephone number 1-800-478-8255, toll-free and statewide. We're talking about science and indigenous people with Craig George, Richard Glenn from the North Slope, and Kate Reedy-Mashner from Idaho State University. And she's an anthropologist. Richard Glenn is a geologist. Craig George is a biologist. And we're kind of exploring whether and how the value of indigenous knowledge becomes more apparent in changing times, because we're definitely in the changing times. And we're seeing that right now. There were a pair of researchers up there on the North Slope looking at the sea ice, because it's been acting a little strange lately. And I'm sure you've been watching that, Richard Glenn. The space images are real clear that you had a kind of a, I don't know if you'd call it a breakup, but you had these huge leads that were appearing and propagating all through the Beaufort Sea starting almost a month ago now.
Right, and we don't even need the space images to see it. It's right in front of our front window. And what's been happening over the past 30 years is a later freeze-up and an earlier breakup and a reduction in this multi-year ice cover, so that when a major storm event, I guess, crossed over the polar basin, it basically unzipped the whole ice cover along the coast from Cape Lisburn all the way to the Canadian High Arctic, and we saw it here. It was impossible to miss, of course, but what you referred to, the satellites showed us that it wasn't just a local event. I mean, we have leads all the time, and the question is how far offshore they are, how wide open they get, and what kind of ice will fill back in after the lead closes. And what this was just a regional tear in the ice cover. And it just, you know, for us, it means be on your toes, be vigilant. The same rules that have applied before apply now, but you cannot afford to keep watching the environment.
Yeah, I'm thinking that this is one of those examples of where things are going to be changing, and we're going to need lots of theorizing and observing and so forth, because the fact of the matter is nobody really knows how first-year ice is going to behave when there's no multi-year ice in the whole Beaufort Sea.
Right, and this is Craig. The other disturbing thing is that the ice broke right to the beach, which typically doesn't happen. It didn't happen in the past as much when there was heavy multi-year ice mixed into the landfast ice. So, and that doesn't bode well for whaling and doing ice-based research, because it just really isn't well grounded.
Yeah, I was thinking that very thing, and I wanted to pursue that in terms of the fall season, which I understand has become pretty problematical. I guess it's better if you're farther over towards Mackenzie. The ice will be in a little closer, but for Point Barrow, the ice can be pretty far away in the fall now.
Yeah, it can be hundreds of miles away in the fall time, and so what you need is calm water conditions, favorable winds. We use the wind, the lee effect of different barrier islands and stuff for shelter or travel when we have to, and it is different now with the later creeping in of ice cover. I understand it might be good for bowhead whales in terms of their population, but it means we just have to be careful how we conduct ourselves in the ocean. And the folks who go whaling in the fall time, typically folks in Cocktovik, Nuiqsut, Barrow, and recently Wainwright has been fall time whaling successfully. And then they've seen a few, now and then they'll see them further west at Point Lay or Point Hope as well.
Yeah, and the when you're that far out, I guess there's also a problem of getting the whale up on the ice and keeping it afloat and on like that.
Well, you should know, right, that in fall time whaling, we bring that whale all the way home to the beach. We always have, and so.
So what do you have to use? Do you use some kind of a flotation thing to enable that process? I've never actually seen that in the fall.
Yeah, so a whale, if everything is going your way, a whale will float when it's dead, and you tow it home. It has a buoyancy, and it sits just right at the waterline, basically, and probably too much details, but a small buoy is attached to his flippers, and we tow him home on a rope, and it looks basically like a dog team. There's a bunch of boats in tandem pulling a large diameter tow rope that's attached to the whale's tail.
Okay, I'm getting a picture now. Thank you. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. And are you picturing, Richard, that having scientific information might become more important to people along the North Slope as time goes on? I'm thinking in terms of the sea ice data, obviously, but also weather because of the you know, the erosion threat now, the big long fetch for the storms that can really eat into the coastline sometimes.
Right. So knowledge of the weather is as important as it has ever been, I think. And, well, yeah, we're very starving for things like satellite imagery of the ice edge. And, I mean, I think let's just say we're more informed with it. And this is one of the unfortunate issues related to modern science. Some of the stuff, whatever's helpful, we use. Everything from VHF radios to whatever. But there's a curious thing going on with this radar imagery. This is called a synthetic aperture radar. It looks through clouds, day or night, doesn't matter, and it's good for looking at ice. And the U.S. doesn't own a satellite that conveys this information back to us, and so we have to borrow it from the Canadians at huge expense. And my dream is that someday a synthetic aperture radar image is going to be just as common as a weather map, and I don't see why it shouldn't. Everybody would benefit from that, but it certainly isn't the way things are right now. And so every now and then we're lucky enough to meet with a researcher who has a project, who's paid the money, who has access to an image. And otherwise, other than that, it's catch as catch can, and that's unfortunate. But we take advantage of every tool at our disposal because, as you know, it's a risky endeavor.
And Craig George, I'm wondering in the Wildlife Management Department, what are the more recent things where the scientists and investigators might have been helpful to your office there in the borough?
Right. Well, that's a good question. And, I guess I'd turn it around and say that, you know, the local observations perhaps have been more helpful to us. Really, one of the more interesting things we stumbled on lately was this question of whether bowheads were capable of smelling an air, and that came up with regard to offshore oil and gas rigs and this sort of thing. And the local knowledge was clearly that whales were capable of smell, but you pick up any textbook on cetaceans, it'll say they're incapable. But we worked with a really good anatomist and got permission to, take apart a whale skull, and sure enough, found olfactory bulbs are present. They're fairly large. And using genetic techniques showed that the olfactory genes are active and all that, and pretty slam, clear-cut case that they are capable of smelling. So, you know, there's been just numerous things like that have been extremely helpful to science. How are we helping them? I think with things that, there's places TK, local knowledge, has limitations. And I know we get a lot of questions about contamination in native foods. That's a place we can help. Genetics or some of these, animal health questions and that sort of thing. I think we've made a contribution in that respect.
Yeah, I'm thinking science is kind of a process of asking questions and formulating theories. And maybe when the indigenous side and the scientific investigators are working together, they come up with better questions.
Yeah, there's no question. I don't know if you want to comment on that, Richard.
Well, I'm just remembering a scene that I think, Craig, you heard this too, that an elder was taking a couple of ice scientists out over a lagoon ice cover, and there was a crack there. And, this is a pretty calm, flat ice area. There was a crack, and then there was some flow, like up on top of the ice. The water came up on top of the ice. And the two researchers just sat there and theorized forever on how this possibly could have happened and what must be the forces going on. And the old-timer, he's a friend of mine, he's gone now, but he just watched them as they bantered about what could be happening, what might be happening, and they finally asked him, "What do you think?" And he looked at them and he chuckled and he said, I think you two have a very healthy imagination.
But you know, just to follow up on your point, though, Steve, I think this took me over 30 years to figure out, but when you're working as a scientist here in this community, you do enter into the sharing network. Of course, it's not native food in this case, but it's knowledge. And the implicit understanding is that you'll give something back that's useful. And, you know, we've really tried to do that. And then once you get that synergy that Richard mentioned earlier, it's so exhilarating to have those scientific convergences occur. And Kate mentioned earlier where you confirm these things like this deep knowledge about whales being capable of smell and then confirming it with some anatomy and physiology work. That's really exciting.
Turning back to Kate, we talked a little bit about it before the show, but I wanted to get it out on the record here about that there was whaling in the Aleutians or on the Alaska Peninsula.
There was. It was pretty intense early on. It was high status, just like it is in the north. And men would use a poison that was from the monkshood root, of an aconite poison, and would shoot the fins of the whales. And then the whales, of course, would roll over and drown, and then they could tow them into shore and pull them on the beach and carve them up. It was abandoned somewhat after the Russian period, and then there was, of course, a commercial whaling station at Akutan in the late 19th century that was pretty intense. They took hundreds and hundreds of every species of whale. It was primarily managed by Scandinavian businessmen with some local labor. And now, of course, the Aleut still eat whale, but they're not actively hunting it. They are, when they find a really fresh one on the beach, if they're lucky enough to do that, they will carve it up and bring some home.
Yeah, beluga's important. Beluga's used, right?
I have not heard of beluga being used in the Aleutians. It's primarily a gray whale, I believe. It's pretty random. People don't really identify species to me when they talk about it because they're scavenging.
Did you ever hear anybody say the whales can smell?
I have heard that, yes.
See?
They should be talking to people in Barrow.
Yeah. 1-800-478-8255. A local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk at alaskapublic.org to engage with our guests on the subject of science and indigenous people as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station.
The Kinnickarm Crossing would connect Anchorage to the Matsu Valley. The bridge is intended to create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and save freight costs for Alaska's interior and North Slope. More information on the Kinnickarm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Convergence between indigenous knowledge and science, and I think we're seeing it happen all the time. I guess my picture of it is that it's science, really, that's been doing the changing, and because their task is less abstract and more pressing now. We have a lot of environmental change going on, and the policy sector is increasingly needing answers. But what we're hearing from our guests is that it's really kind of a two-way process, and especially up on the North Slope, where I think it would be fair to say that there's almost every day exchange with scientific researchers now, and it seems to me that you, Craig George, and Richard Glenn are getting more scientific in your approach as the scientists are communicating more and more with the local people there.
Yeah, I think that's a good observation. And sometimes I've been asked why I've been here, I guess, almost 36 years now. And I think a lot of it is it's just so darn interesting. And this scientific collaboration and synergy that we're talking about, you're right, every day is very interesting. And every day someone comes in my office with some sort of remarkable observation, some hunter that, something he's seen, heard, or an observation. And I write it down. I know the experts are in different areas, and so I make sure I record those. And in fact, has led to some publications actually.
Tell me more.
Tell me more.
Well, for instance, I think it's interesting that all the aerial surveys that were done here, 30 years of surveys, they never saw killer whales, and yet the hunters would say, "Well, we're seeing killer whales every summer," and I get out the mammal guide and say, is this, yeah, definitely, yeah, okay. Finally, I got a call and I took my skiff out and got into a group of about 11 animals. But anyway, we published a paper, Robert Sadam and I, on local observations of killer whales in a scientific journal. But and then finally this year, I think you heard it was a bit of a splash that one of the NOAA surveys had a spectacular sighting of 30, or anyway, a large group of killer whales in the southern Chukchi. But that's another example. When you get hundreds of hunters, or maybe thousands, spread along the coast, and they're talking, that level of observation has high statistical power, you might say. And there's just I guess it should be no surprise that they would see some of the these rare sightings would be picked up first.
I love that. what did you call it? High statistical, what was it?
Value. And then it reaches back into the fourth dimension, right, in time. And so you have the stories exchanged about older interactions with the same situation. And so I've never seen a killer whale in our ocean, but my grandfather told me that if I did, they remember you. If you abuse it, mistreat it, or whatever, not only do they remember your boat, but even if you're in a different boat, they remember you. And so basically, admonishment about treat them right, give them a wide berth, and it's just not something to toy with.
Well, that really resonates with the show we had last week on killer whales, where our guest was Eva Salidas was saying, she has, the intelligence that you're dealing with in that species is fearsome, enormous.
But so I think your earlier question is triggered my thought that another reason why I think this brings a lot of self feeling a good about yourself is that we have a legacy, a history. I mean, there's some of our heroes on both sides of the cultural fence have been involved in this two-way exchange of information. You can go way back, hundreds of years, of course, but the folks like Simon Panner and Lawrence Irving and Pete Suvolich, the guy from Barrow here, and the researchers he worked with. There's a guy named Jess Walker who was a World War II fighter pilot, but he's become one of America's foremost big river geologists. And he studied the Colville River in the 1950s, and he found a folks living there in a sod house, the Woods family, and that they forged a lifelong partnership. They studied the river together, and they had their goal was always just a greater understanding of the river. And it's that kind of, and then Jesse's become a personal friend of mine. I'm lucky enough to get to know the guy, and we stay in touch and write to each other. And so we want to be like those people when we grow up, I think, or at least I do. And there's an incredible legacy our role models has set for us that shows that this is a fruitful place, you know, a nice place to be.
I remember very distinctly, Craig, when you were at a scientific meeting in Anchorage and stood up and gave a eulogy about Arnold Brouwer Sr., just saying, as I recall, we've lost our encyclopedia.
Yeah, that was actually a tough address for me. Yeah, I was got pretty close with Arnold, brilliant guy, and he really he was encyclopedic about a number of things, and what a loss.
Well, yeah, I'm thinking in terms of the continuity of tradition that is embodied in people, that the schools and the education system don't always encourage a carrying forth of an oral tradition. I sometimes worry about those chains getting broken.
Yeah, we've actually been working on that here in the local schools, and and I think it's actually integrated into some of the curriculum. Like later this week, I'll talk with kids about bowheads and a number of different things like that. But I think you're right, and if you do integrate it into the curriculum, the kids find it far more interesting.
Yeah, and it's just it's kind of a cultural thing. I mean, in my culture, you know, we just don't listen to the old people, and you know, when we lose them, then we suddenly realize, oh, geez, you know, I never heard the end of that so-and-so story. Yeah, and you never will. I want to turn to Kate Reedy Mashner here for a little insight on, you know, living traditions and how they can be kept, you know, vibrant and continuing into the future, if you got any insights on that.
Just record, record, record. One of my biggest challenges is just people are passing away. And the number of people that have died, elders that have died since I started working in those villages, it just takes my breath away. It's just been astounding. And kids are interested. Kids want that door opened for them. That's my experience has been that if you put a child and an elder together, they ask lots of questions, and it's rewarding for both sides.
Wow. Out of time. Charles Walforth checked in, by the way, Richard and Glenn. Just want to say hi, and it's great to hear you on the radio. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, thanks, Charles.
And thanks, Steve. It was a great show.
And Kate, I want to thank you very much for coming down to the radio station to be with us today.
Thank you, Steve. It's been my pleasure.
All right. Next time, Business of Clean Energy. Thanks so much to Jessica Cochran today, and Dave Waldron, and Tori at KID Radio in Pocatello.
Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage of state government since 1991. On the web at akbudgetreport.com. The University of Alaska Anchorage, where a freshman computer science course sparked a six-figure career in digital game design. The University of Alaska Anchorage, amazing stories being written every day. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.